This is the 21st. I'm Brian Mackey. In the 20th century, as America prospered, the policy and practice of redlining segregated communities by race, deeming some as undesirable. Over time, neighborhoods with people who were living in poverty and those in racial minorities were deprived of resources and had less access to economic opportunity. Although redlining was banned in 1968 by the Fair Housing Act, its consequences are still with us today. And there's evidence that redlined neighborhoods are suffering more from climate change than other areas. A recent study by the Science Museum of Virginia found dangerous heat disparities in areas that had been subject to redlining. These communities, which exist in cities across Illinois, are on the front lines of extreme heat and other environmental concerns. Joining us to talk more about this is Kim Wasserman, Executive Director of the Little Village Environmental Justice Organization in Chicago. Kim, thank you for joining us today.
Thank you for the opportunity to be here. Really appreciate it.
Also with us is David Harshbarger, who's a research analyst at the Brookings Metropolitan Policy Program. David, thank you for being here as well.
Thank you. Excited to be here.
Listeners, we want to invite you to join our conversation today, 800-222-9455. Maybe you've lived or have lived in a community that was subject to redlining in the past. Are you seeing and feeling the effects of climate change where you live? Or maybe you just have a question for our guests. We'd love to hear from you. 800-222-9455 is the number, 800-222-9455. Or you can tweet us at 21st Show. David, let's take a big picture of you to start. You've written about redlining. Can you give us an overview? What is redlining? When did it begin?
Absolutely. So redlining is an artifact of the New Deal under FDR's administration from the 30s. Essentially, American policy choices determined that homeownership would be the catalyst for wealth building. But they did so in a way which prioritized white homeowners and excluded Black homeowners from building that wealth. Now, the reason why redlining is so important today is because the effects are very measurable, yes, and because we have physical maps that show where discrimination took place. So in 1934, the federal government created what was called the Homeowners Loan Corporation, and that provided guidance to local banks on where they should and should not be making loans to prospective homeowners. Now, the thing that drove this discriminatory action was that they wanted to be sure that they could get their loans repaid. But they did so in a way which prioritized white homeowners at the expense of everyone else, particularly Black prospective homeowners. And we have these maps available today. The University of Richmond has a team of historians that have digitized these maps. And I encourage everyone to go online, look up redlining, University of Richmond, and you can see these maps. And you can see the way in which certain neighborhoods were explicitly excluded, and on these maps actually outlined in red ink, which is where the term redlining comes from. You can actually read the language that they use to describe these places, the words that they use tinged with racial epithets, which really lays bare the sort of fundamental discrimination in the system. Now, as you mentioned at the top of the show, the Fair Housing Act of 1968 made this process illegal. But the vestiges of this are still with us today.
Yeah, and I'm going to put a pin in that, and we're going to come back to that aspect of the conversation. Kim, let me bring you in, and we need to take a break in about a minute and a half. But first, you know, the reason we're talking about this is there's this study by the Science Museum of Virginia, Portland State University as well, found that previously redlined areas are on average 5 degrees warmer than areas that were not. And this is, I gather, heat trapped by cement sidewalks and expressways and warehouses. You get these urban heat islands. Kim, can you talk about what this feels like on the ground?
Absolutely. And I really appreciate the conversation and the connectivity between both of these things, because they're not by chance. These same communities that have been redlined are the same communities where low-income communities of color currently resides. You're talking about the oldest housing stock. You're talking about very dense asphalt, cement-based communities where climate change programs are not happening, right? In Chicago, where you see alleys being redone, where you see weatherization happening, it's not happening in low-income communities of color. In fact, what we're seeing is in continued placement of industries in our neighborhood. And what that feels like is we can't breathe. What that feels like is there's an abundance of diesel trucks running through our community. What that means is that as a neighborhood, we're not only having to deal with climate change, but we're also having to deal with all the health impacts that come with more air emissions. They come with less park space. They come with not a lot of trees in our community. And so it's kind of
and like you said, sorry to interrupt you. We can't breathe, literally. We're going to continue this conversation. We do need to take a break. You are listening to the 21st. We're talking about the past history of redlining and how those effects are still being felt in neighborhoods today, particularly as it relates to heat and climate change. This conversation will continue. Stay with us. This is the 21st. I'm Brian Mackey. If you're just tuning in, we are talking about past practices and policies of redlining, segregating communities by race, particularly lower income and communities with racial minorities, and how those effects are still being felt today, particularly with regard to climate change. There was a study came out not too long ago that found that areas that had been subject to redlining are on average 5 degrees warmer than areas that were not. We're talking about this with David Harshbarger, who's a research analyst at the Brookings Metropolitan Policy Program and has written about redlining in the past, as well as Kim Wasserman, executive director of the Little Village Environmental Justice Organization in Chicago. Listeners, we want to invite you to join our conversation, 800-222-9455, especially but not only if you have lived in a community that was subject to redlining in the past, or maybe you just live in a place and you are seeing and feeling the effects of climate change where you live, or you have a question for our guest, 800-222-9455, 800-222-9455. Kim Wasserman, I'm sorry, I had to interrupt you for our break. I don't know if you want to finish your thought. You were talking about, you know, mitigation of climate, things that are being done in cities, not necessarily being done in the neighborhoods that were subject to redlining. And, you know, if you want to pick up where you left off, or you can talk about, you know, how this temperature increase we're talking about puts the well-being of people in these areas at risk.
Absolutely. And yeah, just to go back to that point, you know, what it comes down to is our community's inability to be able to breathe. We can't breathe because of the air pollution. We can't breathe because of how hot it's getting. And when you talk about cities like Chicago and you add the humidity on top of it, it makes it difficult. And these communities are already facing with health issues. Like, it's not like our communities are in perfect health. We've been living in these neighborhoods. We've raised our children in these neighborhoods. And so they're having health impacts. They're worsening the health conditions that folks have. And so it's literally about just our inability to be able to breathe in our communities. And unfortunately, these are the communities that need a mitigation of climate change first and foremost, yet they're the last ones to receive it. So quite a struggle, quite honestly, in our communities right now.
You know, Kim, I'm reminded as you're talking about the Chicago heat wave of 1995, I think it was 739 people died then, mostly elderly from lower income neighborhoods. A lot of them couldn't afford air conditioning. Kim, do you think people are still vulnerable in the way they were in 1995 today?
Absolutely. You know, I think particularly given the COVID and the economic distress that our communities are under, absolutely. And so, you know, every year there's new weather impacts. Every year we're seeing the heat rise. Every year we're seeing more folks in our community being impacted. So I wish I could say that we're in a better position than we were in the 80s when that heat wave happened. But unfortunately, if something like that were to happen this summer, I believe that unfortunately we would see similar impacts in our communities because not a lot has changed within those same communities when it comes to resources, when it comes to fixing the issues that have historically plagued us, starting with redlining.
So David, you mentioned a while ago, redlining outlawed 1968, dust our hands off, problem solved, right? No, obviously not. What are some of the lingering effects of redlining that we are still seeing today beyond what we're talking about now?
Right, exactly. Well, of course, the first thing was to make these processes illegal, but we know that sometimes this still goes on. There's racist sort of steering practices in which Black prospective homeowners may be sort of shown homes that are in neighborhoods of less socioeconomic standing, whereas a white prospective homeowner might be shown a wider array of neighborhoods, but it goes beyond that too. These neighborhoods were divested from, and you know, if you track mud into the house, maybe you close the door, but you eventually have to sweep up the mess as well. You know, it's one thing to stop people from tracking mud in the house, It's another thing to actually clean up the problem. And what we see is that today, if you compare redlined neighborhoods to neighborhoods that weren't redlined, these are still predominantly low income and often majority minority neighborhoods. As Kim mentioned at the top of the show, there's older housing stock. There are sometimes less neighborhood amenities, and certainly a lower tax base in some of these communities. And so the legacy of this doesn't go away when it's made illegal, and especially not when sometimes these processes still occur.
And David, I wonder if you have anything else to add on the intersection of redlining and environmental justice, or the lack of environmental justice in some of these neighborhoods.
Yeah, absolutely. Kim made a great point about, you know, the history of the dangerous effects of heat. And of course, this is a cross-cutting issue that goes to the root of every challenge that we're going to face. Climate change poses challenges untold. We don't really know exactly how this is all going to play out, but we know that because Black neighborhoods and majority minority neighborhoods did not have the political power to put up a fight against some of the processes that made these neighborhoods have, for example, less tree cover, less green space, more asphalt. These places that can generate heat can also retain water and make them prone to flooding. There's a whole host of potential environmental challenges. And I think what we'll see, and what's been laid bare through the experience of COVID over the last year plus, is that those in our society with the least power are the most at risk. And that is going to that's going to dictate the future. The future is a policy choice about how we respond to those with power and those without.
Kim, I gather we talked earlier about urban heat islands, right? Sidewalks, expressways, warehouses, and how that traps heat in cities. The lack of trees and vegetation, I gather, is another factor in these higher temperatures in lower income neighborhoods. Kim, you've done a lot of work, I understand, helping organize community gardens and green spaces in Chicago. Can you talk about why that's important?
Absolutely. You know, in our community on the southwest side of Chicago, we were one of the most densely populated communities in Chicago with one of the youngest community bases. Over 50% of our population is under the age of 25. Yet in our neighborhood with such a large population and such a young population, we only had one park for many, many years. And having that amount of young people with no access to open space and just as a community at large was just an environmental injustice, quite honestly. And so for us as a community, it was really important to not just fight for more park space, but to really make the connectivity as to why, both for physical health reasons, for community development reasons, but also for our young people and our elders in the neighborhood. And it's quite mind-boggling to us that in this day and age, it would take us 20 plus years to actually even fight to get a park in our neighborhood. Because if it wasn't the funding issue, it was the lack of, it was the fact that we have one of the most racist park districts in the nation here in Chicago. And so, you know, all of these things I think really bring to bear, right, the history of things like redlining, the history of things of like who makes decisions in our communities. And it's really based on a racist system, right? Like, why is it that communities of colors cannot have park space? Why is it that communities of color have to fight for 20 years to get a new park in their neighborhood when they only have one for over 95,000 people? And so, you know, the campaign for us has always been around access to land, around access to the community developments that we want in our neighborhood. If we left it up to the city, they gentrify and displace our community with a heartbeat. For us, it's really about ensuring that we have an enclave in Chicago for low-income communities of color, but that they have all the resources that they need, that they have the housing stock that they deserve, that they have a chance to access clean air, clean land, and clean water, just like everybody else in the city. And so the work isn't just about like cleaning up the air. The work isn't just about cleaning up the water. It's also about cleaning up our land and access to land for all of our community members in our neighborhoods, not just those that are rich, those that are elite, but also for those that are new immigrants, for those that don't speak English, and for those who are not U.S. citizens, quite honestly.
As we are going to air this morning, one of our producers here on the show just shared the U of I as posted a press release announcing a study that I'm going to just read from the sort of summary here, found that more green spaces in an area is associated with a lower racial disparity in coronavirus infection rates. Their study is the first to examine the relationship between the supply of green spaces and the reduced disparity in infectious disease rates. Kim, in 1998, your son suffered an asthma attack that you learned later had been triggered by air pollution caused by a coal plant about a mile away from your house. Can you talk more about that experience and how it, you know, spurred your advocacy?
Absolutely. You know, my parents are longtime organizers in our neighborhood, and I was convinced at a young age that that was not going to be the life for me. And then I had a kid, and at 3 months, he had his first asthma attack. And in the emergency room, the physician there was like, hey, where do you live? And what's, you know, what's in your neighborhood? You know, along with like, is asthma in your family, which it was. But he really helped me understand that it wasn't just about being hereditary. It was also about the air quality in my neighborhood. And it turned out that, in fact, we had a coal power plant in our neighborhood. And it really got me thinking, and it turned me onto this organization to really try to understand, why was there a coal power plant in our neighborhood? And like, is this in everybody's neighborhood? And it turned out that in Chicago, we still had two coal power plants, one in Pilsen and one in Little Village. These coal power plants did not provide electricity to the city or the state. And in fact, in our neighborhood, there was nobody who worked at the coal power plant. And so really it became for us a question of why are we being exploited as a community? Why are we being sacrificed for the sake of this coal power plant to make money and to provide electricity to somebody somewhere else when we as a neighborhood aren't getting an economic benefit from it? And we're definitely feeling the environmental impacts from it. 40 plus people a year died prematurely because of the coal power plant in our community. And so for me, it really became a fight, not just for my kids, but for all the kids in our community to have the ability to actually have clean air to breathe. And also, as I mentioned, a concern around how was our land being developed and who are the economic opportunities in our community for? Are they for the people who live here or are they for people outside of our neighborhood to come into our community and benefit from? And so that campaign really opened my eyes to understanding, again, how decisions in our community get made and how we have to fight to have a better voice in what happens in our neighborhood. Because if we leave it up to the city, they'd still have the coal power plant running. We still wouldn't have a park. And what they would be telling us and what they've told us is, well, if you don't like it, move. And I refuse to accept that. My family has been in Little Village for generations and I want to raise my family here.
David Harshbarger, research analyst with Brookings Metropolitan Policy Program. We're coming to the end of our conversation. Can you talk briefly, what beyond what we've heard Kim talking about at the sort of neighborhood and city level, what are people doing to address the legacy of redlining?
Yeah, that's a great question. And I think it's great that the legacy of redlining is becoming more and more of a salient issue in today's politics, because it's a fundamental piece of understanding our nation's history. I will add that redlining is an important but not completely exhaustive view of all the sort of housing discrimination that has taken place. It's certainly the most tangible and that we can see the maps. And again, I'd encourage anyone who is maybe listening in Chicago or Peoria or any of the other cities in Illinois that were redlined, go take a look and see if you live in a neighborhood that was redlined. You might be surprised. But this isn't the only way that the housing discrimination took place. And the way that we're going to address redlining is the way that we should address housing inequality and wealth inequality writ large. It's a tough problem. I don't think it's unsolvable, but I think that it requires a lot of political will, and it requires a lot of people being willing to invest directly in neighborhoods that were divested from. So understanding this importance, this historical importance of redlining, as well as other forms of historical discrimination, is really important in building the political will to reinvest in these neighborhoods. Like I said, it's not enough to just shut the door after you track mud in the house. You got to sweep it up.
Kim, final word to you in less than a minute left, maybe. What would a healthy and sustainable environment, neighborhood, however you want to take it, in Illinois look like to you?
Really what it comes down to is the self-determination of community members. And that what that means is that communities can decide for themselves, not only what the problems are, but more importantly, how to fix them. And that's something that's drastically missing right now, is that these same systems that created the redlining and uplifted it and continue to benefit from it are the same systems that think they can fix the problems. And that's the problem. Is the same people that made this mess cannot be trusted to get us out of it. It has to be the community members. We have to center those most marginalized in our response to how to fix this. And that's what green, sustainable communities in Illinois looks like, is when they get to be centered.
Kim Wasserman is executive director of the Little Village Environmental Justice Organization. And we've also been speaking with David Harshbarger, who is a research analyst with Brookings Metropolitan Policy Program. Kim and David, thank you so much for being with us today on the 21st.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you for the opportunity.
And that is all the time we have for our program today. You can stay up to date with us on Twitter. Just search for 21st Show. We are at 21ST Show. We tweet out links with analysis and background about what we've been talking about. You can also go to our website, 21stshow.org, to find our link to our Twitter page, Facebook, every other way to connect with us. And you can find links to subscribe to our podcasts. We're also on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, and NPR One. You can find a link at our website or just go on those platforms and search for The 21st. Our program is produced by Anna Casey and Ryan Wild. Chantal Vaca is our engagement producer. Our interns are Zainab Qureshi and Brielle Skullark. Technical direction and engineering from Jason Croft and Steve Mork. The 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media. I'm Brian Mackey. Thanks for listening.